I will open the Subcommittee on Natural Resources for Monday, April 9th, and open up a public hearing on House Bill 5024, the Department of Forestry, and House Bill 5002, the Department of Agriculture. We have a very interesting presentation this evening. We had discussed for some time having at least one hearing outside of the natural resources normal meeting times and outside of our the Capitol. And I thought personally it would be nice to have a hearing on the future of agriculture and forestry and natural resources in general at Oregon's one land grant institution. And I thought that this is a perfect time since we're right in the middle between the forestry and the agriculture budgets. And we're soon going to go to ODFW's budget. I would like, since people will probably, people up here probably know many of you there, but not all of you, but I would like you to know some of the members on the committee. So I'd ask them to give sort of a brief introduction. On my far left, not meant to be a political.
Nothing could be further from the truth, Mr. Chair. I'm Representative Bill Verard from Klamath Falls.
I'm Representative Jackie Dinkfelder, Northeast Portland.
I'm Senator Devlin. I represent the communities of Lake Oswego, Westland, Tualatin, and a portion of Lower Southwest Portland.
Senator David Nelson. I live in Pelton. I represent four counties in Northeast Oregon: Morrow County, Unicoya County, Union County, and Willow County.
And Brad Avakian, State Senator from the Portland Beaverton area. I'm a proud 1984 OSU grad. Go Beavs.
Well, with that, we will start off this evening. First, we have a presentation on the future of natural resources in Oregon from four different areas. And what I'd like to do is I go through each one of them and then have just a few minutes for questions before we go on to the next. So we're going to start off with Katie Koba, the Department of Agriculture Director, and Thane Dudson, the Dean and Director of the OSU College of Agricultural Sciences Agricultural Experiment Station.
I'm Brian Klamath.
Yes,
I'm Brian Klamath, State Representative for Salem area, alumni from Oregon State.
Chair Devlin, committee members, my name is Gail Achterman. I'm the director of the Institute for Natural Resources here at Oregon State University and also a special advisor to the Vice President for Research. And I was asked by your staff and the others organizing the presentation to just kick off today by talking a little bit about the future, introducing the future, the topic of the future of natural resources in Oregon. I think all of you are very well aware as committee members that there are 15 different natural resource agencies in the state of Oregon. And when you look at those 15 agencies and you think about what they do, what their functions are, and what the dollars you choose to invest in their functions mean to Oregon, natural resources are truly the foundation of Oregon's economy. That was true historically. It's true now. And in spite of what lots of folks used to say about the old economy and the new economy, it's true in the future. That carpet in the Capitol with the sheave of wheat and the fish and the tree is going to resonate into the future. When you think about the fact that the Oregon Business Plan for 2007 identified sustainability as Oregon's competitive advantage. And if you look at forestry and agriculture and fish and wildlife, these fields and industries are really critical to creating sustainable sustainable communities, sustainable economies, and environmental sustainability for the state. And the key thing that I hope you're going to hear over the course of the presentations today is this very critical connection between the 15 state natural resource agencies whose budgets you're responsible for and the Oregon higher education system, including the public service budget and, of course, the budget for the Institute for Natural Resources, which I head up, where the universities provide essentially the R&D work as well as train the research, the workforce for this very important industry in the state. And that's why so many of the critical initiatives of the Oregon Innovation Council are really, the innovation for the future is really grounded in our expertise, both in industry and in research around agriculture, forestry, fish and wildlife, natural resources and the environment. So that linkage between the higher ed investments and the agency investments is critically important.
Thank you. Ms. Coleman, Ms. Dobson, please proceed at your leisure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good evening, members of the committee. I'm Katie Koba, Director of the Department of Agriculture. And first of all, I want to thank the committee for holding their hearing here at Oregon State University. I'm not an alumni, but I didn't go to the University of Oregon either, so maybe that lets me off the hook a little bit. But I do think that Gail pointed out in her comments, the link between natural resources and this university is absolutely critical. I'm going to speak specifically to agriculture because it's the part that I know the most about. But we in the Department of Agriculture work very, very closely with Oregon State University. We have a very strong partnership. And one of the things that I have learned since being in this position is that's not true in every state that has a land-grant institution where their departments of agriculture and their land-grant institution collaborate well together. So I think that's really credit to our respective agencies. I certainly can't take credit for it because I kind of moved into a situation that was very nice, and Dr. Dudson maybe can take a little more credit for it than I have.
Been here longer.
That's right. So for us, it's a very good thing, and there are a number of points that I will speak to in the brief minutes that I have, and then Thane will expand on a little bit more. I've handed out for you a piece of paper, but I don't want to go through it in detail because, frankly, you're going to see me again in 3 days, and you're going to hear more about the industry that you probably would want to know or can even remember. So I don't want to be redundant tonight, and I thought specifically about what it was that I wanted to leave you with tonight that might be different than what we talk about in our budget overview beginning Thursday. And first of all, I think the first message that I would want to leave is that agriculture in this state is doing very, very well. We hear an awful lot about the challenges to the natural resources-based industry, and to some extent that's true. But I think in looking back over the last 20 to 30 years in Oregon, our friends in the forest products side have had more of a challenge than we in agriculture have had, and you can see it in terms of some of the roller coaster ride that they have been on, the reduction in logging and hence the reduction in their contribution to Oregon's economy. Agriculture, on the other hand, has had a slow and steady presence in Oregon from 20 years, 30 years ago to now. Every year, we see just a steady contribution to the state's economy. We tend to see a trend line that's gradually increasing. It doesn't jump up real high, and it doesn't drop down real low. Part of the reason for that is because of the diversity of the industry in the state, over 220 different commodities. So, for example, the commodity that my family raises that Senator Nelson is so familiar with, wheat, has struggled. Basically, the last decade has been very, very tough for those in the wheat industry, but we have seen other segments of agriculture that have done very well, and so that tends to balance out on the whole in terms of what the industry does for our economy. That's not to say we shouldn't overlook the struggles that we face in wheat or maybe dairy that we're seeing right now, but it does lend a very broad and balanced input in terms of Oregon's economy. Do we face challenges? Sure, we face challenges. If I was to name three simple areas that we pay attention to, more so than perhaps we realize, one is land availability and how in the future we're going to make decisions about what to do with our land. We can see it right now with the battles around Oregon's land use system. The second would be water. And we're certainly hearing a lot about water in the building these days and the fact both water quality and water quantity. We continue to grow in Oregon. We will continue to grow in Oregon, and we are going to face increasing demands upon water, and how we choose to allocate that scarce resource is going to become, I think, more and more challenging for all of us. And finally, air. Same issues as more impacts, businesses, people live here in Oregon. We impact air and air quality. So three simple things: land, air, and water. All the things that we need, certainly in agriculture, to survive. The final point that I'd like to make is, I think looking back in history on this era right now, we are seeing a monumental change in agriculture, and that is because of the focus on renewable energy. And I think in 10 to 20 years, we will look back and say that was a critical juncture for the industry, not just in Oregon, but in the United States. The discussions that we're having now in terms of how we allocate those scarce resources of land, water, and air, and are we using it for food production or fuel production? What is that going to do for the price of food? Are we willing to pay more for our food here in the U.S. than we have before? We as a country probably spend less of our income percentage on food than any other country in the United States, in the world. We're spoiled. As Americans, we are spoiled. And we are going to begin to see more and more pressures, I think, on these resources, and we're going to have to make more and more strategic decisions about how we use them. The opportunities around renewable energy for our industry are unbelievable. And we are already seeing it in segments of the industry that are doing very, very well, and we're seeing some challenges, particularly in the livestock industry because of the price of food. Feed prices going up significantly, and that having serious challenging consequences for producers to remain competitive. So finally, as I hand it over to Thane, we in Oregon, as we look at what we do on a day-to-day basis, we have to be competitive. We have to be competitive with our neighbors in Oregon. We have to be competitive with our neighbors in the Pacific Northwest. We have to be competitive in the domestic market, and we have to be competitive in the global market. We don't just look at what Idaho does or the Midwest does. We have to see what China is doing and Mexico and South America. And the only way that Oregon can continue to be competitive in this global market is through research and innovation. We've got to be smarter because our costs are higher. And so that's where we looked to institutions like Oregon State University to help us be smarter, to help us innovate, to help us be competitive so that we can produce a product that will compete in a marketplace against a China or a Mexico or an Iowa. So with that, maybe we should shift over to OSU, and then if there are questions between the two of us, we'll figure out how to answer them.
Thank you, Katie. I'm Thane Dutson. I'm the Dean of the College of Agricultural Sciences and Director of the Oregon Agricultural Experiment Center here at the OSU. I'd like to reiterate the close cooperation that we have between our programs here at OSU and the programs with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. We cooperate with many of the other natural resource agencies. The Department of Ag is our core partner. And I am the envy of many of the deans of agriculture around the U.S. because of that close cooperation. Many of them do not have such close associations, and I'm proud of that. But I also appreciate the input. We share the Food Innovation Center in Portland, for one example. We work very closely on research on new pest management issues. We're constantly together working out one issue or another in various parts of the state. Water issues, land issues, and production issues, individual production issues. But I think more importantly, the Ag Development and Marketing Division of ODA is one that is really the envy of many of the departments of agriculture around the nation because of the work that they do in development and marketing. and we share some of that with the Food and Innovation Center. Now, let me just talk a little bit about what we do here at Oregon State University. We essentially, as a land-grant university, have three key missions. One of those is research. Another is education and workforce development for students that we train in the classroom, undergraduates as well as graduate students, but also our extension and extended education work, which is also workforce development for the people who are running the businesses, people who are associated with the natural resource sector. And I feel that we have, over the years, provided excellent service to the state of Oregon in those areas. And let me just give you a few of our statistics for the College of Agricultural Sciences. We don't graduate enough students to meet the job demand. And in fact, nationally, there are more than 10% of the jobs that go unfilled in food and agriculture-related sciences than we have graduates for. So there are empty jobs out there, and our students, if they're willing to go where those jobs are, have good jobs when they graduate. Most of our students have a job within the first year of graduation. Some students have jobs before they graduate. There's a national ranking of number of students graduated, and that national data covers over 160 institutions. And it's agriculture and natural resources, so it's forestry and agriculture combined here at OSU. But we rank right now fourth in the nation in the number of graduates that we graduate. But that is going to be really difficult to continue under the situation that we have right now. We're a smaller institution. We don't have as many faculty. Our budgets aren't as big, but we still graduate a lot of students. That's PhD graduates. And we rank 8th to 12th in the number of undergraduates that we graduate. Our extension programs enhance the working knowledge of current businesses and employees of those businesses and owners of farm, ranch, and other processing operations. They take that research that is conducted around the nation, but a lot of it here at OSU, put it to practice and put it on the ground. The combination of the research and extension just in the agricultural sector that we do here at OSU last year created over $200 million in the state's economy. Now, that wouldn't be there if we didn't have the people on the ground taking that research and that information from our extension folks and putting it to work. But essentially, we not only provide some of the building blocks of the economic engine in the state, but we also provide some of the fuel for running that economic engine. And I have a database that actually calculates that for each one of our individual projects. So if any of you would like to see that, I'd be happy to show you. Some of you have seen our database, and we calculate that every year, and right now it's about almost $210 million this past year. Now, that's first-level economic advantage. That isn't multiplier effect in the economy. So the multiplier effect comes on after that. We create, in addition to that economic advantage, numerous environmental advantages. And we actually, in our database, measure the environmental advantages to the state of Oregon as well. And we also try to measure the social advantages that we create. A lot of it in rural communities, but a lot of it in Portland as well, because many of the jobs in Portland wouldn't be there if we didn't have a strong agricultural sector. one other piece of data relative to our research, and our research is really core for the Agricultural Experiment Station. Just a couple of months ago, there was a publication came out from Thomson Scientific that ranked the scientific impact of publications from a number of different institutions around the U.S. in various fields. In the field of agricultural sciences, Oregon State University ranked number one in the nation. And that's better than Purdue, better than Ohio State, better than any other institution that conducts research in agricultural sciences. We're ranked number one. We are at jeopardy of losing that quality of research if we don't continue to take care of the base funding. We bring in a considerable amount of funds from outside. 70% almost of our budget comes from other than state funds. So we bring in a lot of other funds to match the funds that we bring in from the state government. Now let me just talk about some new strategic directions. And Katie mentioned one of those, and that is bio-based energy systems, using new plant materials instead of plant materials that have been in the ground for millions of years is, we think, a real opportunity, and you can see it in the agricultural economy right now. In addition to that, bio-based products for health and for disease prevention. Many of these plant products and even animal products that might produce energy also have components that we could extract out before the energy is produced so that we can have new products for health and disease prevention. We continue to conduct research that shows anthocyanins, chlorophyllins, just many, many of the different components in the products that we raise here in Oregon have cancer-preventing and heart disease-preventing capabilities. Food innovation. There are numerous opportunities, we think, to create more direct connections between the production system and the consumption system. And that's really where the growth is right now in the food production and marketing sector, is in that sustainable systems and in those systems that connect the production system to the consumer system. Water, watersheds, freshwater, and both marine aquatic resources. There are a lot of resources and bioproducts in those freshwater and marine resources. We need to figure out ways to use those to advantage. Ecosystem services. We think there is a real opportunity for Oregon to provide ecosystem services using numerous of the plant materials that we raise and use those in bioremediation and other remediation purposes for the environment. One other thing that you might have seen that we feel in Oregon is a benefit to us, and that is the new directions of the Farm Bill and the new budget in for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. There's an organic section in there. Oregon has been a leader in organic production. There's also a section in the new Farm Bill proposed for specialty crops. Well, Oregon is pretty much a specialty crop producer. So we feel that U.S. Department of Agriculture is moving to an Oregon advantage as well. Thank you for your time.
Any questions?
Yes. How does the co-chair's budget affect all these fine programs?
Well,
Dean, in about 60 seconds.
National championship, dude.
Yeah, baseball, slow pitch. Essentially, these programs that I talked to you about have gotten hit really hard in the last few years. And the budget that came out of the Board of Higher Education proposed an increase for backfilling some of the losses that we've had. And the governor's budget did also took some of that away, but still left some on the co-chair budget, essentially zero to that. So essentially, some of these programs that we're living off of that were there before 2001, 2003, where we hit budget cuts, we're essentially living off of that reputation. We've lost a lot of faculty members in that period, and you'll see a chart later.
I just think the investment we need to make in research, technology development is absolutely critical for the health of the industry. So we have concerns when we see what kinds of budget cuts operators do or student cuts or other cuts.
Thank you, Bill. For forestry, Marvin Brown, the director of the Department of Forestry, and Hal Salwasser, terribly. Dean and Director of the OSU College of Forestry and the Forest Research Laboratory. I'll see you again. Come on, please.
Thank you, Chair Devlin, members of the committee. Yes, for better or worse, you've seen a lot of me and get to see a little bit more yet. But we have had several chances to talk about just some pretty broad brush issues facing forestry in the state. And this is a good chance to put an exclamation point on a few of those, so that's what I'll do. We did give you a handout, I think, and I'll hit some of the highlights from that handout. Things I want to talk about, the challenges that affect the future and of forests in the state, and really what are some of the policy leadership needs that we have to overcome those challenges, and what are some of the investments that are important to overcome those challenges. And when we think about challenges, the word you've heard from us a little bit over the course of our hearings is the notion of a tipping point, that there's a set of policy decisions and investments that we can make that tip us in the direction of maintaining a good, healthy, sustainable forest resource. And there is a set of decisions and choices that can be made to take us in the other direction, where we start down an even more accelerated path to lose the value from forests. Some of the values at risk are all the things that everybody wants, ecosystem values, biodiversity, clean air, clean water. We're talking about carbon sequestration, wildlife habitat. There's also, by some notions, for every billion feet of wood that's harvested in the state, that represents about 17,000 jobs. So as that harvest level goes down, it certainly affects employment. And then there's substantial economic value just around the marketing and infrastructure that goes with the forest industry. Those are the kinds of values that we think are, you know, the ones that need to be considered as you look at the tipping point that exists here. The challenges that seem to be pushing things in the wrong direction. It's not a statewide unique concern, but they're all over the United States. There are lots of pressures to move what we call working forests out of that condition, so that they're no longer actively managed for the whole set of values that exist for forests, and basically either converted to other uses or set aside and essentially not managed for anything. Become someone's private play farm is one of the things that happens to a lot of them. But there is substantial pressure and trend towards moving forest lands out of those sets of forest values. some of that influence is global, and the challenge is connecting with that global influence, both understanding it and finding ways to impact it. It's certainly easier to study it than to impact it, but I think there are ways that it can be impacted. It's a little bit of a stretch sometimes for people to think that why is the State Forestry Agency worried about what's happening in Asia or South America, but the influences are profound, and it's nobody should presume that what happens in Brazil doesn't have an impact on what happens in America, because eventually it does. People have not lowered their expectations about what they want from forests. In fact, they want more all the time. At the same time, there's a lot of land that is not effectively managed to produce all those values, and we have a challenge of trying to improve management. And you've heard from us about the challenges represented by the federal land in Oregon. 58% of the state, the forests in the state, are owned by the federal government. Their policies are not policies we can directly impact at this point, and the policies that have a profound influence on the values that are being delivered to forests. And, unless we can find a way to start to influence those more effectively for the benefit of the state, I think they're going to continue to represent, some problems for the state. There's a need to invest in new technologies. You heard that from agriculture folks. It's the same in forestry. We need to invest in education. Trying to find out what are the incentives that are going to make people want to own and invest in forest land. Are there things that we can explore beyond simply stumpage values that make people see this as a valuable thing to own and invest in, the ecosystem values and things? We've got a lot of advantages in Oregon, and that's what's interesting about the whole discussion. I grew up in the Midwest, and when I first came out here and started working on some of these lands, I called some of my friends from the state where I grew up one day. I said, I just walked by a log that was laying on the ground out here in Oregon that had more board feet on it than what we grow on a whole acre in Missouri. And that was the truth. It was, the numbers are astronomically different between Oregon and many parts of the world. It is truly a world-class forest that exists here, and that's a huge advantage. The state has also a history of applying smart rules and laws and regulations to keep those forests in forests. There are good Forest Practices Act, a successful land use law over time, a Board of Forestry that has been actively engaged in policy leadership for some years. They also have, what's considered one of the best forestry schools in the country, and Dean Salwesser will be able to say more about that. And a lot of other unique and important partnerships and programs that have developed here that really other states look at and are jealous of, such as the Oregon Forest Resources Institute, the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watershed. There are access to markets like places like California is a significant advantage that Oregon has. So we've got lots of things to draw on, but are we going to make the investments and the policy choices that take advantage of those or not is a question. I'll just say a few things about some of those needs for policy choice and investments, and then I'll turn it over to Dean Salwesser. We need to continue to make sure we've got a good forest practices law. That means constantly updating the science so that landowners are asked to do things that deliver the most effective result that is intended. Riparian protections, wildlife measures, reforestation standards, those are all science-based things that need good science and good information to keep evolving and keep being efficient. We need investment in what creates a higher level of productivity out of our lands. Investments in marketing, what are some of these new markets that would allow us to capitalize on the advantages that the state has. We've talked some with you all about the growing urban wildland interface concern, the effects that it has on keeping lands in forest and also just delivering the values that forests provide. There needs to be some deliberate decisions about how we interject our own efforts into making that a result that everybody's satisfied with. We've talked with you about some of our protection challenges and fire and things like sediment stuff, so repeat those. One thing we haven't talked about, and I'll mention just briefly, is roads. One of the phenomena that goes along with a disinvestment in forest management is people not investing in the kind of roads that protect water quality. Folks need to have income and revenue streams that allow them to make capital investment in their property. Roads are the most significant capital investment for protecting water quality. And when people are not generating revenue, then that capital investment goes by the wayside and water quality is threatened. And that is happening in some parts of the state. There's other things here, and I will let you look at that at your leisure and turn my time over to Dean Salwasser. The one issue that you all, I think, have gained some appreciation for is the level of conflict that exists around forestry. And it's something that I wish if you could solve that for all of us, you would have a much more successful forestry resource. But it's something that is real, and it's something I hope all of you all have some appreciation for, like I've grown to appreciate over 35 years. It's very difficult to make people happy, and the level of conflict ends up expending huge amounts of energy when you're a public resource agency. So anything we can do to lower that conflict is a good thing. But I'll turn it over to Dean Salwas.
I think there is that conflict, but actually when you said that, I was thinking of the director of ODFW that's in the application hearing this evening. And I think there's more conflict probably than reason.
There's always somebody to work on.
Yes, Dean.
Chair Devlin, committee members, I'm Hal Salwasser, Dean of the College of Forestry and Director of the Oregon Forest Research Laboratory at Oregon State University. We are celebrating our 100th year of forestry at Oregon State this year, and we're having a great time celebrating the many accomplishments and contributions that our programs have provided to the state. Our graduates, our research, our outreach education all contribute major parts to a forest and forest product sector in the state that's a $12.5 billion a year economic engine directly employing 85,000 people in companies, agencies, and consulting businesses literally scattered throughout most of the state. In our education and workforce missions, we've turned out over 5,000 graduates in our 100-year history, and those people have worked for every nature of forest organization, from agencies to private sector to consulting businesses to environmental organizations that are teaching in the schools and universities. Our enrollment right now is at a 25-year high. For 2 years in a row, it hit a high. And it's up 42% since 2001. Great news. The downside is we have no more dollars to educate those students than we had 6 years ago. And it's really stretching our capacity and impacting the quality of the experience for the students. Furthermore, the projected workforce demand in Oregon from the state agencies, federal agencies, private sector, and consulting groups, because of the retirement bulge that's occurring now and will for the next 10 years or so, the demand far exceeds what we have in the pipeline enrolled in our programs. And companies and agencies can't simply go to other states to find the employees because the enrollments in forestry in other states are actually going down as they've changed their programs and their direction. We've got about 500 undergraduates right now, and in at least three of our degree programs, forest management, forest engineering, and wood science and technology, 100% of them get a job if they're looking for one in their chosen discipline. We also have 140 graduate students and master's and PhD programs, and those students all get jobs too. Many of them are employed in academic institutions. Our research function, we are the forest resource research agency for the state, and you'll hear a lot this session about signature research centers. Well, I'm going to claim that the Oregon Forest Research Laboratory was one of the first signature research centers the state created. It's a real powerhouse. The state appropriation through the Forest Research Lab budget has recently been around $2.7 million a year. The faculty and staff at our college take that $2.7 million and go out and leverage about $16.6 million, a $6.1 leverage. And that money is coming in from federal grants and industry contracts, and it employs people. They're creating a lot of jobs. We have research on every aspect of forest resources with the exception of paper, which we let the University of Washington take care of. And we've got 10 research cooperatives, everything from tree genetics to utility pole preservation. Some notable examples of breakthroughs that have happened recently, you may have read about the formaldehyde-free glue that one of our scientists in wood science, Kai Chang Lee, developed a way to take formaldehyde out of the adhesives that are used in interior panels. Another professor, John Garland, has worked with a nylon rope to replace the steel cables that had great improvements in safety and in workforce safety. Dr. Rakesh Gupta works in the use of wood in construction in the homes that can withstand earthquakes and is in demand across the country for his expertise. Dr. Barbara Bond figured out why trees don't grow any taller than they do. It has to do with their ability to get water up to the top. And Daryl Ross, another one of our professors, developed a way of using natural chemicals to either repel or attract insects to deal with insect epidemics in an organic way. So we also have the deepest, largest forest resource extension service with 14 faculty on campus and in the field and 7 on campus, serving over 100,000 families who own forest lands, about 4.5 million acres in the state. With that, I'll close and be happy to take any questions.
I have one question I actually spoke to you, Mr. Brown. A few months ago when we met at a reception in Salem, Mr. Brown, he came to see me and committee to both brought up the issue about changing the ownership of forest lands. What do you both think the long-term implications are?
Chair Devlin, I'm having a hard time seeing a real positive outlook from the changing ownerships because we're moving from companies that had 100-year histories with the same piece of land in the communities, and it's going to companies that have a shorter time horizon, sometimes as short as 10 to 15 years. My hope is that this changing ownership will settle out somewhere soon, and that we won't continue to see further fragmentation and changes in the ownerships. But we're one major company away from no longer having a vertically integrated, publicly traded forest land-owning company in the state.
Thank you, Chair. And actually, that's one company away from having one in the nation.
Yeah.
Actually, there's only one left. Since another company out of Texas has announced their intention to sell their property. So there's only one left. One of the things we know with some level of confidence is that every time those large properties change hands, about 10 to 15% gets spun off into what's called higher and better use, essentially into development out of non-forest. As Dean Salwasser mentioned, a lot of the companies that are buying these for the first round are not companies that intend to be in the business forever, are into that specific ownership forever. They do have a horizon where they'll turn the land over so that it gets revalued within their portfolio and maybe invest in something else. So there's going to be accelerated turnover, and when there's turnover happens, at this point, it's always meant there's less working forest on the landscape.
Yes.
So when one of these like real estate investment trusts turns it over to someone else, what is it that would protect it from being developed? Is it our land use laws? Is it healthy companies in the market and fair restrictions on things they can do? What are the keys?
Chair and Representative Clinton, that's a really good question. And there's two or three different ways to approach it. One is to enact laws that basically require a landowner to do specific things without providing them any value for doing that. Another way is to try to create value for the land that motivates them to do something other than turn it into a development. Those are two policy choices that the government always has. Right now, some of the figures that we have is Idaho the real estate value for much of the forest land in Idaho is 6 times the forest management value. And so you've got to add a lot of value to make a difference there. In Western Oregon, it's more like 2.5 times in many places. And but so I think, you know, what my own biases are trying to figure out ways that make the land more valuable as a forest investment, whether that's the ecological values, clean air, clean water, carbon sequestration that they deliver. Is there a way for landowners to capture, you know, actual cash for their investment for those things? I think is one thing that's really important.
Any additional comments or questions? Seeing none, thank you both very much. I would remind people that are in the back that we still have some available seats up front, so if you're tired of standing, you'd like to come forward. I think we still have at least 5 or 6 seats up front that aren't being used. Next up will be Fish and Wildlife, Roy Elliker, the Deputy Director of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and Dan Edge, the Chair of the Department of Fisheries and Wildlife at Oregon State University and Commissioner of the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission.
Thank you, Chair Devlin, members of the committee, and I do appreciate this opportunity to come before you tonight. I know you've had a long day when I brief new employees on the legislature and what happens over in the Capitol. One thing I am very clear about is, frankly, for the time you're in session, nobody puts in longer hours or works harder than the Oregon State Legislature. So I appreciate the opportunity to be here tonight, and I'll keep my remarks short. I know I'll be in front of you, and Virgil will be in front of you in just a few weeks. Looking at a handout, we tried to capture a little bit, Mr. Chair, some of the issues that you were interested in. Everybody knows our mission is statutory authority. But in particular, in the department, we feel that the future of fish and wildlife in Oregon is dependent on the state's ability to effectively identify the value of those fish and wildlife resources, analyze how to best balance, sustain those values, and take action in support of the resulting management objectives. And when you look at economic value of fish and wildlife resources in the state, they are vast. They surprise most people, particularly those who don't hunt and fish and make their living in the outdoors. Fishing, hunting, wildlife viewing activities particularly benefit small businesses and rural communities. While many participants may live in larger cities and towns, they recreate in rural areas. A couple excellent examples for those of you who like to go salmon fishing. When you go to Astoria late in the fall for the Bowie 10 fishery and see hundreds of fishing guides with hundreds of clients a day, there are times that you look out from Bowie 10 and see a couple thousand of aluminum fishing boats that were all built in the Northwest, particularly Oregon, that are, a lot of them have Oregon guides employed. Those are Oregon and Washington fishermen out there taking advantage of that one particular fishery. And you think about all the gas that's pumped in Astoria and Rainier and Warrenton and all the money that is coming in as a result of that fishery, and that is one single fishery on the Oregon coast. We can say the same thing for the month of October in Tillamook Bay, where, again, it's anywhere from 500 to 3,000 boats, particularly on a Saturday, out in the bay, taking advantage of that fall Chinook and Coho runs. And there are many, many folks who are diving out there, making money. It's their business to be out there with clients. It is a big business in the month of October in the town, a neighboring town around Tillamook Bay. And those are just two examples that we can talk about and show that kind of immediate impact to our smaller communities and rural economies. Overall, according to 2001 numbers, Fish and Wildlife Service, Federal Fish and Wildlife Service, who does every 5 years, does a review, basically felt that Oregonians spent $602 million on fishing-related activities in Oregon, $365 million hunting, and $769 million on wildlife viewing activities. We've broken that out in that chart there in the middle of page 3. It is a very big economic contribution that fish and wildlife makes to the state. And we also get quite a sizable contribution from non-residents. Those non-residents come into the state for the kinds of fish and wildlife experience and outdoor experience that they get here. Over 20% of licensed anglers are non-residents. About 8% of hunters are non-residents. And the wildlife viewers, my two best examples for wildlife viewing, the Waterfowl Festival this month in Burns, will attract hundreds of people from around the Northwest and the United States, if not thousands, for wildlife viewing on the private lands and public lands, the Mount Hear National Wildlife Refuge and surrounding private lands. And that is a huge deal for Burns every April. And when you go to Klamath Falls, the Eagle Festival in February, Representative Gerard, I'm sure, will attest that that is a big moneymaker for the community with lots of visitors and tourism, an important source for the local community. And those are just examples of the things that go on around the state on those issues. To finish up then, looking at these values, how does the department and how do we work with Oregon State, but how does the department and the commission balance sustain these kinds of values? First of all, the agency develops policies that support a science-based process for conservation recovery planning, implementation, and evaluation. We have three good examples there: native fish conservation policy, particularly for native trout, the coastal coho conservation plan, and sage grouse conservation strategy. The coastal coho plan in particular, the department takes great pride and the commission takes pride in that, because we feel that in our way, by the state taking the lead on implementing recovery and balancing the needs of fisheries and the fish themselves, it saves many private landowners, businesses, and state and local governments from more costly federal entanglement with federal rules, federal laws, and those kinds of things. And it's up to the state to step up and take advantage and show that we can manage our resources without heavy federal oversight. The Oregon Conservation Strategy, which we'll talk about in May as we come in front of this committee, was put together through a federal initiative with each of the 50 states, but essentially it's a new way to look at endangered species recovery and implementation. It's driven by concerns that the state ought to be the one to manage for species and habitats before we have to take compensatory actions for protection, or so other neighboring folks or other landowners have to worry about these species and habitats. The Oregon Hatchery Research Center, a cooperative research project between the School of Fisheries and Wildlife and the Department of Fish and Wildlife, Dan will probably speak on that a little bit here on his talk. It's been online for several years now, and we hope to learn some great things there. Besides the research that will come out of it, it is a tremendous teaching platform and a place for young fishery students at Oregon State to learn about the business of fisheries and fish management. And then lastly, I do want to be aggressive without mentioning that looking about sustained values, some of our select area fisheries that provide opportunities for sport and commercial fishing, we'll talk about more in May, but in particular the Southport Flats Kenai project, where we work with the county, local fishermen, recreational fishermen, the federal funding, including Bonneville. It's probably about a 10-to-1 match between the federal funding and the state local funding, which is a huge match to deal with and provides the funding for fisheries for commercial and recreational value and markets. Anyway, those have finished my remarks, and I appreciate, Mr. Chair, the opportunity to be here tonight and your time tonight.
Thank you. Mr. Hitch, it's been a few years since we've seen each other. Take this I was on the Rules Committee, I believe, when you recommended that you be appointed, and you looked a little bit grayer.
I'm going to suggest that it sounded like a personal problem that you are on that committee.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's the problem.
Thank you.
I hope it isn't the assignment to.
Yeah, no, I'm having a good time. Thank you so much for your concern, Chair Devlin and committee members. Once again, I'm Dan Edge. I'm the department head in the Department of Fisheries and Wildlife at Oregon State University. And I'm also vice chair of the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission. I wanted to share with you some ideas or some perspective of what we're doing from the standpoint of three missions of Oregon State University, education, research, and extension. From the standpoint of education and workforce development, our graduates are primarily employed at state and federal agencies, but also in private natural resource companies, such as some of the timber industry, environmental consulting firms, and other environmental organizations. There is a substantial need for workforce development in this area and all the natural resources, primarily as a result of large influxes of employees in federal and state agencies associated with environmental laws in the late 60s and up to the late 70s. And we now have a workforce that's been working 25, 30 years, and there's a huge retirement falls coming. And Dean Salwasser talked about not being able to meet that need, and I think that's the case with fisheries and wildlife as well. We offer a bachelor's of science in fish and wildlife management, where the students specifically design a specialization that of their own. We enroll approximately 200 students each year, and that enrollment has been steady for a number of years. Employment at the bachelor's level is not as good as some of the statistics you've heard elsewhere. For years, we've talked about a master's being the entry-level degree, but over the last 5 or 6 years, because of this retirement pulse, employment is like 60% for permanent jobs in fisheries and wildlife professions within 3 years of graduating. At the graduate level, we offer Master's of Science and PhD degrees in both fisheries science and wildlife science. We have approximately 120 graduate students currently. It's a very large program, one of the largest ones in the country. We have very high employment success with our advanced degrees. Virtually all of them with jobs in various fisheries. We are developing graduate certificate in marine fisheries management to help retrain some of the professionals in the workforce. We are one of the leaders in distance education here at Oregon State University. We offer a minor in fisheries and wildlife associated with a natural resources degree. Enrollment in our classes has gone up approximately 20% per year for about the last 5 years. Our graduates sound like a who's who in fish and wildlife management across the country. They are everywhere, not just in this country, but throughout the world. Our graduates, for example, currently include the director of the New Mexico Game and Fish Department, includes the director of the Fish, Wildlife, Range and Watershed Program for the Forest Service for this region, several of the members of the IMST have been graduates of our department. The architects of the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watershed, the graduates of Fisheries and Wildlife at OSU. One recent PhD student was recognized as the Young Scientist of the Year from the American Ecological Society last year. From a research perspective, it's important to recognize that all of our faculty members both teach and do research. They all hold appointments in agricultural experience station that Dr. Dutson had talked about. Each the $600,000 in state investment in that area generates $6 to $7 million in research grants and contracts from mostly federal agencies each year. So we have a large leverage area. Our research you would characterize as applied, collaborative, and multidisciplinary. And we've talked about, we've heard about some of the signature programs. The Oregon Hatchery Research Program is a unique opportunity where the three missions of Oregon State University, teaching, research, and extension, come together with Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife at a unique facility. Other examples are the Pacific Northwest Ecosystem Research Consortium, which has developed a planning database for environmental change for the entire Willamette Valley. Sage-grouse research and sage-grouse ecosystems, Marine Mammal Institute, those are some other examples. From the standpoint of extension, most of our extension efforts are in the area of aquatic resources. We have substantial extension programming in fisheries and watershed management areas, educational support of the Oregon Plan, marine fisheries education. However, we have little or no extension capabilities in the area of wildlife extension since we lost our wildlife specialist in 2001. And I guess there's high demand for that kind of information, activities associated with animal damage management, habitat enhancement on private lands, endangered species, and of course lots of interest in large predators such as cougars and wolves. And with that, if you have questions, I'm sure we'll answer them.
Any questions? Seeing none, thank you both very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I do not know if we're going to Extension Services. Commissioner Mondrell, oh, she's here. Come forward. And Scott Reed, the Dean and Director of the OSU Extension Service.
We do recognize that the extension service is in a different subject, but we'd actually like to hear the presentation, and I think there are a number of advocates on the committee for the extension service. Fair point.
Absolutely.
Please proceed.
All right. Thank you very much, Chair Devlin and the committee members. My name is Linda Madrell. I'm here today as a Benton County Commissioner. I'm also the second Vice President of the Association of Oregon Counties and the Association of Counties, Western Counties liaison to the Extension Citizens Advisory Network. Oregon's natural resources have a tremendous impact on Oregon's counties, both economically and in terms of self-sufficiency. This is a crossover issue that affects both rural and urban areas. It affects those east and west side of the state. And Oregon State University Extension Service is right in the middle of this action. The Extension staff represents the university as emissaries, carrying with it relevant research information. These folks are in the front lines every day with day-to-day issues around economic development. The Extension Service is an example of one of the longest partnerships and collaborations in Oregon, that of the counties and Oregon State Extension Service. The counties contribute, I'm going to say, and help me with this, Scott, about 20% of the funding. State government contributes more than 50%. And the remainder is contributed by the federal government and from fees and those sorts of things. This is a wonderful partnership. Now, the balance in that, the relationships of those funding streams has changed somewhat over time as the federal government has reduced more and more over time its contribution to the Extension Service. And for me, as a county commissioner, I appreciate more than I can say the participation of Benton County's Extension staff in almost every natural resource-based activity in the county. In addition, our staff chair, Rick Fletcher, is integral to Benton County government's management team. Rick brings to our team a perspective that is beyond the county borders and at the same time that of a professional interacting day-to-day with Benton County citizens but still kind of outside the mantle of government. And that being there, interacting day-to-day with the citizens around economic development and other issues is one of the benefits that Oregon State University accrues from the Extension Service. It's really the genius of this kind of an organization. Oregon's base of diverse natural resources supports the industries, as you well know, farming, ranching, forestry, fisheries, hydropower, recreation, tourism. I can speak to the value of the agriculture and forest businesses in this county to the tune of about $180 million a year. This is just the base level of their contribution to our economy. Christmas trees are a big deal in Benton County, and they bring in about $20 million a year. And the Extension Service brought to that industry issues around improvement in the genetic complement of those trees. But this is not all that the Extension Service does. And you've heard previously from Fish and Wildlife, for example, agriculture and forestry, about their industries and what they do for Oregon. Well, you know, there are about 13,000 miles of rivers and streams in Oregon that are listed as having limited water quality. There are also species that are listed as threatened or endangered, you know, fish, animal, plants, a little bit of everything. And these challenges affect streams and rivers and species throughout the state. To compete globally, there is a need to balance the sustainability of Oregon's natural resources, the viability of the natural resource-based industries, and the health of rural and urban communities. That is where the Extension Service is essential. I'd like to talk a little bit more about water. As a county commissioner, I need to know several things about water in order to work with others to develop water policy that can help the communities in this part of the Willamette River Basin to thrive economically. You know, I need to know where is it? Where is the water? Who has it? How can we best use it? Is there enough? Can we drink it? Does it make sense to treat our way out of water quality problems? What about the birds and the bees, not to mention the fish? Will we have to buy fish from China when the ocean is less than an hour to the west up from where we sit right now? To help with all of this, with all of these questions, Extension is in particularly apt to deliver university research and best practices to county governments and to a number of other organizations and businesses throughout the state. To that end, the Extension Service has been involved for about 30 years with Sea Grant and more recently with Watershed Stewardship. Oregon Sea Grant works with ecosystems and habitats. It works with fisheries, understanding and how to manage fisheries. That's the food connection to some of my questions. Marine and aquatic science, literacy, education for youth and adults. Seafood science and technology. In the seafood area, they look to value-added processing. And so that's sort of a wrap-up on the Sea Grant segment of the Extension Service and its connection to all the water kinds of issues that I'm really concerned about. And as you know, water quality and habitat quality are dependent on leveraging our nature's landscape to do its stuff and keeping our water cool and clean. And this is good for people, agriculture and forestry, not to mention all the recreational opportunities and the critters, both in the ocean and in the freshwater. All of these things wrap up to impact our economic robustness. The Extension Service has this Watershed Stewardship Program, and this works similarly to the Master Gardening Program, where volunteers are engaged in programmatic instructional issues, and in exchange for that, they either volunteer their time, they help staff things out there in helping. They also take this knowledge to improve perhaps their own private property, their land. The kinds of projects include wetland restoration projects, urban riparian restoration, and as I mentioned before, owner improvement projects on privately owned land. This and the Sea Grant program all contribute to water quality, habitat improvement, food supply, all of these issues associated with water. The Extension Service works with every college and each statewide service at Oregon State, as well as institutes that have been established at Oregon State. They also work with resource industries, soil and water conservation districts, the RC&Ds, that's the resource conservation and development organizations, watershed councils, the county fairs, and they help to educate both the adults and the kids statewide. They come in quietly, they provide information, they convene stakeholders, and they facilitate problem solving, all of which lend to the health of our communities and the health of our economy. Thank you.
Mr. Reed.
Thank you, Chair Devlin, committee members. I'm Scott Reed, Director of the Oregon State University Extension Service. I can really do no better than Commissioner Modrell, who is very articulate about the role and value of the Extension Service, which is a statewide education delivery network with offices in every county. Approximately 70 to 75% of our work is focused on natural resources, primarily in agriculture, forestry, and marine resources. Other key programs, however, focus on the human resource and needs in our state, including the popular 4-H Youth Development Program and one that we call Family and Community Development, organized in the College of Health and Human Sciences. On an annual basis, the Extension Service reaches about one-third of Oregonians with a 90% approval rating, I'm happy to say, as a result of a recent statewide survey. And we share that work in the delivery of programs with more than 20,000 volunteers that we train and support, such as the Master Gardener program that Commissioner referred to. On average, each Extension faculty member supports 112 volunteers and reaches about 4,000 Oregonians on an annual basis. Now, I've produced a handout for you that I've called Natural Resource Futures and Implications for Extension, only some of which I'll highlight in the interest of time, and especially batting cleanup like this, my colleagues have covered many of the same points. Now, futuring is exciting because you can kind of take a guess and then not be around to be responsible for when you, if you found out. But actually, as I've listened today and prepared my own comments, I think we're looking much closer in than a half a century away. It's kind of like the side view mirror on your car. Objects are closer than they appear. Now, the first part of my handout I called Looking Forward, Events, Trends, and Challenges, and there are three that I would call your attention to, the environment, energy, and finally political and social structure. So you have the full list there. I'll just kind of highlight a few things that I think are particularly meaningful. We've talked about and can recognize things like climate changes, water availability and quality, the development of markets for environmental services, including some real innovations right here in our own state. We're literally leading the rest of the country and the world around what environmental services are and how we compensate people for providing them. Rapid channels for replication of kind of ecosystem movements around threats like pandemics, for example, is a good potential event and trend. Around the area of energy, we've all been able to identify peak in fossil fuel use and availability, development of alternative transportation modes, increasing focus on people's lifestyle and their environmental footprint is of some interest and significance from those community members who talk to us, and increasing concentrations of urban populations. In the area of political and social structures, if you follow the flat world thinking, we're clearly heading towards more cultural homogeneity. And as a result of a recent Ocean and Coastal Futures Commission that we had on campus, they made a clear case that there will continue to be migration of populations toward ocean shores in states like Oregon. And so we need to think about what the implications of that are for us. There is a concern and question around the desirability of humans to age in place as society ages. Next door today, we're hosting a gerontology conference, and a speaker there today referred to what she called the silver tsunami. And how can we as a university and extension service prepare people for adopting the lifestyles that will be important for them to stay in their homes as long as they can? Other things around political and social structures, like ubiquitous information, instant worldwide communication, which allows for quick diffusions of innovation and quick diffusion of the information that we can help to provide. There are a lot of global implications around things like labor skill sets, movement of people and blending cultures, but there are also local implications for things like transportation solutions, the development of bioenergy, and food systems, things that are sustainably produced and close to home. So the second part of my handout said, what are we going to do with all this? What are the implications for extension into the future? So this is my kind of short-term crystal ball. We need to continue to work to establish partnerships, and there is no more partnership than the one we enjoy with local government that allows us to literally put a front door to Oregon State University in every county of the state. We also need to seek efficiencies and to consider the way in which the Extension Service can really serve as the informational delivery arm of state government through forming partnerships with other state agencies, as we have long done with agencies like agriculture and forestry. Skill development defines a real clear part of our future, where we need to and continue to work with community leaders to develop adaptive strategies for change. And here I mean communities of place and communities of interest that are statewide. And finally, we need to focus on innovative learning opportunities. This is our investment in technology, where we need to develop and package information so that people can learn what they need and when they need to learn it. And that will mean the use of information technology in order to use the online learning environments that so many people use.
Any questions? Senator Nelson.
Thank you. First year, I have been a counterpart from my county, and I told you how Bill Hanson was in the world. Somewhat demoralized, and really was concerned not only with the extension, but with other things that the co-chairs told me was has potential for energy partnerships in the urban county. What's your view of that?
Gee, I never think of this being urban here, you know, but yes, I agree with Commissioner Hanson. short chair's budget does have some damage effects. Of course, I'm not in their position. I don't know what they're looking at long-term, meaning I'm not aware of, but, you know, contributions to the universities, to the extension service, in addition to, there's a number of things that the co-chairs differ with the county.
Scott was there, and Scott was in the local partnership. I'm going to talk about that.
Before you respond to this question, Trip sent the art to me. He has another Measure 37 discussion from his house.
Could you do something about that?
I would just say, Senator Nelson, local partnerships are critical, and it's the partnership with the county that allows us to have a presence that that creates relationships to the NGO community, non-governmental organizations, and others that share our mission of empowering people with information.
Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Now we're going to actually have a little bit more time. We have,
what do you mean?
We just don't know how to talk to each other.
But we have some student presentations, the student experience in natural resources, and I'd like to bring up the three students from the College of Agriculture. If they can improvise and pull up another chair.
I imagine.
And here we have Wade Foster, who's a junior in the College of Agricultural Sciences from Lakeview, Oregon. Andrew Schaefer, a junior in the College of Agricultural Sciences from Boring, Oregon. And Jamie Jaber, a senior in the College of Agricultural Sciences from Coos Bay, Oregon. And we ask that you just talk a little bit about your experiences in natural resources. And I think, in a sense, it's interesting to me because obviously you're people that are a lot younger than I am, and younger than most of them. And so you're planning a future in natural resources, so we'd like to hear that. So please start off, and you can use 3 or 4 minutes each.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Devlin, and the committee members. I've always had a passion for natural resources, mostly because I grew up in a rural setting amongst natural resources, and I also had a family that was really proactive with natural resource in combination with livestock production. So with those two things in mind, I decided that Oregon State had the programs and the things that I needed to pursue a career around those two basically like ideas that I wanted to go with. And once I got to Oregon State University, I found that the Rangeland Ecology and Management program was the one that I was going to go with to pursue that end. And as a result, I was able to learn a lot from the professors and other faculty, such as Extension, to build a sound ecological foundation and understanding of the landscape, as well as have the management tools in which to pursue the career I wanted to go for. And so I was actually able to use those skills and basically my knowledge by being a rangeland management trainee for the Forest Service on the Lyell Whitman for the past 3 years. And so that was really comforting to know that I was using what I was learning, as well as that I really wanted to pursue this career and go forward with it. And so that, coupled with a year overseas in New Zealand learning about how they manage their natural resources through the College of Agricultural Sciences, as well as club activities and involvement through the college, I was able to be very competitive for a job I was pursuing at the Society for Range Management meetings in February. And there I was offered a permanent position with the Forest Service on the Ocheco National Forest as a range manager. And I'm very excited to do that. I'll go ahead and start in June, so it's kind of nice to not have to worry about the job thing as soon as I get out of school, and I'm very happy about that. And over a career, I will hope to answer the questions about resource management, basically how are we going to manage the resources sustainably while allowing for multiple use, things like public grazing and recreation, while still allowing for adequate fish and wildlife habitat. And I'm very excited about that. I would also like to point out that there is going to be a huge turnover in natural resource professionals over the next 10 years, especially in the federal agencies. And I really do hope that Oregon State University students fill those positions, mainly because I'm very comfortable with the education that they're getting, and I know through collaboration that we'll be able to manage natural resources into the future. Thank you.
Yeah, my name is Drew Schaefer, and my major is horticulture. I'm representative from Student of Agricultural Sciences, Chairman Committee. Natural resources is a huge part of Oregon. I think we all can agree that I think sustainability is going to become a huge issue within the nation. Natural resources plays a big aspect in that. We're using a lot of our resources, and the Pacific Northwest is one of that has a strong environment to meet a lot of those needs with a lot of our agricultural forests and such. And I really think, I'm really scared with all these budget cuts, because we're on some cutting-edge research. And I think it's really important that that can continue through on the years. I know, especially in my major, we're doing a lot of green roof and other things that affect our environment and affect, you know, issues like global warming, many different things. And if we don't get the money for that research, I don't think we're in any position to take a step back. I think, Here's a hypothetical situation, okay? I don't know if we have any sports fans, but let's go back to the college national championship, okay? We just beat Reed in the semifinals, and let's say the athletics department said that they're taking the budget cuts, and Coach Casey will no longer be coaching, you know, for the playing North Carolina in the championships, right? So, what are the chances of our boys still winning, in the championships? And I really think that that Oregon takes pride on the aspect that, you know, we won, and especially Oregon State. And, I mean, the role that a coach has, I don't know. I mean, let's say that these budget cuts, we're going to have to start cutting faculty members, what a coach has the role of training his I don't know. I mean, I look them as teammates to becoming, you know, national championships, perfecting them, all that kind of stuff, practicing. That's same as a faculty member. He's there every day with the students, working, teaching them. And then, take it a step further again, like I was saying, with the pride that we have in that. Our research is national known. I know I was just at the Planet Student Convention in Wisconsin last week, and I couldn't tell you how many multiple colleges came up to me in Florida and made the comments, about our biofuels projects that we have going on, you know, about our green roofs. I mean, we're on some cutting-edge stuff, and we're making so many step forwards. We're almost to the championship, and these budget cuts would really put us a step back, and I'd hate to see that happen. Thank you.
All right. I'm Wade Foster. I'm a sophomore in agricultural business management. I've got a couple of years left here. The main reason I came to Oregon State is because I knew that it would put me through the program. I would come out as a well-rounded student. I would have a pretty good shot at getting a job in the agricultural industry. My story is a little different. I didn't grow up on a farm or a ranch or anything like that. I grew up on a ranch at 8 acres of dry land with one calf and three dogs. So I was in a small town, but that's about the extent of my agricultural background. I actually started natural resources and then kind of transgressed into agriculture. But these programs at OSU, you know, we're creating well-rounded students here. Like Drew talked about, the cutting-edge research. the other day I was walking through campus, and we have the Daily Barometer. It's about a four-page newspaper keeping the students up to date on campus life and a few entertaining editorials. And I happened to pick it up, and I'm flipping through it, and I flipped it over to the other half of the front page, and lo and behold, OSU is number one, and it wasn't baseball season yet, so you know, obviously it wasn't sports. And I started reading through it, and it was actually our...
Some of us focus on football.
Some of us do.
Some.
Okay, that's my fetish.
I'm not going to touch that one. But anyway, I flip it over, and it says OSU is number one, and that was by a Science Watch survey, and we're number one in agricultural science research, as cited in science journals. And that's OSU, that's Oregon State University, number one in agricultural science research. We're number six in geoscience research. So, kind of interesting, we're leading the nation in agricultural science research. And I know Commissioner Modrell talked a little bit about the Extension Service, and she touched on the youth, and everybody else talked about Extension and touched on what it does for industry and what it does for this and what it does for that, but my first experience with Extension was when I was in fourth grade as a 4-H member. You know, I took my pig to the fair, and the Extension Service was right there, and our Extension agent was right there. And I worked with the Extension Service throughout high school. I was talking to our Extension agent, you know, once a week, once a month, throughout high school for my ag classes or my biology classes. So they don't just affect industry. They aren't just affecting higher education. They're affecting K through 12. They're right there, you know, making the rubber meet the road. Another thing, just in closing, because I hope you guys have some questions for us. I would really appreciate a few questions. But do employers look at your K-12 experience? Yes, it's important. It builds a foundation. But when we get, what are employers really looking at when you get to college, when you get up here in the higher education level? That's where the employers are going to start, you know, pulling you out. In Jamie's example, already having a job secured in the Forest Service. So public universities, they're a public institution, they're a public investment, and hopefully they're a public commitment. So with that, questions?
Questions for the panel. Senator Nelson and Senator Avaki.
Thank you. Did you discuss tuition issues as far as students are concerned?
Tuition issues. Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, or Senator Nelson, sorry. Tuition issues. Tuition is on the rise. OSU kind of tried to stop it with a tuition freeze. So basically, if you take 12 to 19 credits, you're going to pay the same amount of tuition. I'm not sure how much longer that took. 16?
Yeah. Ooh,
I'm in trouble then.
I just found that out today. I got charged with $120 per credit over 16.
I'm going to be dropping this. Anyway, that's interesting. So, but obviously tuition is an issue. And through the freeze, there's some other issues that arise. They can't charge as much through tuition, so they'll levy a fee here or they'll levy a fee here. And basically the money isn't out there from the state level or from the national level, so it's got to come out of the students' pockets. And there's some students, I've worked with the student government on campus, I've worked with several groups on campus, and they're talking about it, and you know, they're fighting for students. How can we get these students money so they can actually go to school? And a bigger question is, if these students make it to school, what is college going to look like? Overcrowded classrooms, you know, textbooks that cycle every 3 years, so you have to buy a $124 textbook when you could have bought it used at $58, but the textbook company won't let you buy it anymore. There's some real issues in that area.
May I make a statement? Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson. Let's say tuition doesn't change and they cut faculty to protect students' tuition. Just like Wade was saying, I mean, the effect that would have on the classroom sizes, I mean, it's difficult, so difficult as it is right now trying to get into classes. You know, classes fill up so rapidly. Everyone wants to take the same classes. Everyone needs to take the same classes. And if we can't get into it, we have to wait another year on some occasions before we can get into that, and then maybe we won't be able to get it into the next year because your classes are judged with on your standing, So seniors get first dibs, and so they may be taking the classes that you need, and you may not get into it for 2 or 3 years. I've known that situation to happen many times. It's happened with me in business administration. It filled up way before I got into it, even most juniors and stuff. So, I mean, it's just like a chain of events that will happen, you know, with just one instance. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Devlin also serves on the committee that writes the state budget for education. So maybe we get him back to Oregon State with his other committee. I don't know.
We'll be back in Corvallis.
Yeah. Yeah. We'd like to come talk to you.
Actually, Chair Devlin is one of your greatest champions on public education in Salem. A couple of you mentioned, Jamie, you touched on it in particular, already thinking about jobs and what you might be doing with these degrees when you're done. And with Wade, right? And it being sophomore, I don't know how focused you are on that yet, but I wonder if the three of you could talk a little bit about what you're envisioning for yourselves when you're done with your education here. And for those of you who have actually talked with potential employers, how many of those are in-state? How many of those are out-of-state? Is that an issue for your colleagues as well?
Since you have the firmest idea of what you're at.
I got a few of that.
Okay. Let's see. Okay, so you want to know just basically what I'm envisioning in the future as far as my career goes?
For the three of you, but also I'm curious about whether you're staying in Oregon, whether you're going out of Oregon, whether employers from out of the state come here to visit the campus and try to recruit you.
Okay. I guess I can speak for my department, and I know that we constantly are getting announcements from out of state through email. A lot of the jobs that we'll start out in are in the federal government or state, and so there are a lot of out-of-state offers. I know that recently when I went to the Society for Range Management meeting where I got my job, there was only one Oregon position open at that time. So, and I know that that's going to change over the next couple of years, so especially within the next 5 to 10 years. So I think that, at least in my field, there'll be more Oregon jobs in the future. They're just not here now. But overall, it seems like there are quite a few out there in Oregon, and then just that many more outside of Oregon. So it depends on the student's willingness to move, if they want to or not, what's tying them down or not. So in that experience, anyway.
Okay, so... Little backstory. I worked at a golf course for 4 years before coming to Oregon State, and that's where I kind of got my drive in agriculture. I came to OSU in horticulture with a sports turf and landscape management and design. That was my option. And we have this intro class to where, people involved with horticulture, like the field, come in, like companies and stuff, come to talk to students. And ProGrass, a landscape company out of Wilsonville, was there. And, I mean, as I started going to Oregon State and taking some classes, I really found out that I love plants a lot. And I knew I was in the right major. And what ProGrass had to say really pertained to me, and they offered this internship. It was their first year doing it, and so I signed up, got the interview, got the job, and I got to check out all the aspects of the landscape company, and that's exactly where I want to be, because I like working with people. I like still being around plants, and it's an amazing opportunity, and so that was just the beginning. With my advisor, I mean, this is a big thing about the College of Agricultural Sciences, is your advisors take care of you. They you are individuals. I mean, that's what the kind of opportunity that we have. We're kind of a smaller college, but, I mean, it's more beneficial because the faculty-to-student ratio is so high. My advisor because one of my goals for my next internship was to go overseas, and my advisor got me an opportunity to have an interview with Hillier Nurseries in England, and so I'm going to be spending a year over there, and I mean, I can't wait. Because one of the other reasons why goals that I wanted to set was to get a lot of plant knowledge and care. I mean, and who knows that better than the English who started gardening and everything. And so I'll be able to work in a nursery, arboretum, and botanical garden. They have over 600 acres. I'm looking to make a lot of networks there. Within Oregon, ProGrass offered me a job by the time I graduate. And the salary is very nice, and they said in 10 years they would make it into six figures. I've also got I've had a bunch of job shadows with many companies around Oregon to kind of the way I look at it. I'm sorry, I know we're short on time. Is I wanted to. Yeah, no, don't worry. I'll speed it up. The way I look at it, the industry, I wanted to find out what the industry needed and what I could do or what education I could get while I'm at Oregon State that would make me a hot commodity when I get on the market. So I job shadowed with two companies, Pacific Landscape and Dennis's 70s. I don't know if any of you guys are familiar with them. And both of them are very interested. They both are fighting to get me in the internship. They actually don't want me to go to England and stay here and work for them over the summer because they want me to get in with their company by the time I graduate. When I was in student career days in Wisconsin, Brickman, the largest landscape company in the world, offered me to go into their arboretum and to the Brickman University so I could become a part of their company. And I got about like four other companies, but I'll stop myself short. So, I mean, Oregon State has given me all these opportunities and the connections, the networking. I mean, we're in with it all, and it's. I mean, I'm so thankful and I'm very lucky.
Hey, Jock, I think that.
There you go. Yeah. I was thinking about a bench.
Okay.
Six speakers,
you got it.
Yeah. All right. Chair Devlin, Sir Avakian. Really, as a sophomore, I haven't really started looking at jobs after college yet. I know I probably should start. But every week, my advisor, Jody Richardson, in the Department for Ag Business Management, she sends out her weekly info email. And in that email, there's usually 5 to 10 internship opportunities every week. And some of them, granted, are repeats. Some of them, granted, are working on the Simplot Ranch, you know, checking cows late at night. But there is a lot of It works. It works.
But that's how
we
keep the prices down.
But there's a lot of opportunities. There's a lot of internships that I see roll through my email every week. And basically, I haven't got to a point in my college career where I'm looking to take an internship. I'd really like to begin the internship process next spring, my junior spring through the summer, maybe into my senior fall. But I got to see what's out there, and I need to focus more in my college career at this point.
I'm a sophomore, too, and I can give you some good tips.
Before we go on to the next panel, I was just going to comment that Ms. Jaberg is in your position is with the U.S. Forest Service, but my chief of staff, her parents are both professional foresters, and they traveled, well, my chief of staff grew up in Oregon and literally traveled the entire state in different U.S. forests, and her parents are now working towards retirement. They have a few years left there in Alaska, which is where they wanted to actually end up. So. But they've enjoyed their career. So. Thank you both. Thank all three of you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.
I have to say that my committee's been very good in staying attentive. They start each morning, well, by the time we start committees, at about 8 a.m. in the morning, and they're still going at this time of night. So our next panel is from the College of Forestry. We have William Hoskins, a senior in the College of Forestry from Rhododendron, Oregon. Chalon Sheffield, a graduate student in the College of Forestry from Glide, Oregon. And Rachel Collin, a junior in the College of Forestry from Summer Lake, Oregon.
And please start, identify as you speak your name for the record. And good to see you, all three of you.
Well, good evening, Chairman Devlin and committee members. My name is Will Hoskins, and I'm a graduating senior in the Forest Engineering Department in the College of Forestry, OSU. I chose to come to OSU primarily for two reasons. One is the excellent quality and value of the education here, and the other is the close proximity of that education to my home at Welch's, Oregon. Initially, I came to OSU because of the reputation of the engineering college, but soon after my enrollment, I learned that OSU was home to, arguably, the world's preeminent forestry program. As I had an interest in engineering, the discipline that seemed the best fit was forest engineering. Growing up as I did in Welch's, near the Mount Hood National Forest, I had the chance to see forest products harvesting in the flesh very often. I was amazed at how this massive, heavy equipment was moved into and worked in the woods over some of the most difficult terrain imaginable, all the while producing a valuable and renewable good that society demands. Naturally, when I learned that one could obtain a degree in the planning and management of such operations so that they would be safe, economically sound, technically feasible, environmentally responsible, and socially acceptable, I knew I'd found what I want to be when I grow up. When I transferred into forest engineering, I had no idea of the truly world-class quality of the education I would receive, nor did I realize the rarity of the institutions that provide such an education. Only three institutions in the United States offer forest engineering as a full degree, and OSU has the only one that maintains a curriculum accredited by both the Accreditation Board for Engineering and Technology and the Society of American Foresters. The forest engineering at OSU is distinctive in many other ways. Throughout the junior and senior years of forest engineering, numerous classes never leave the classroom at all. Instead, we head for the field in the College of Forestry's 11,000-plus acre McDonald Dunn Forest, where the theories of the classroom are applied. I cannot emphasize enough what a rewarding and vital part of the curriculum this fieldwork is. It is what makes the graduates of the forest engineering program of OSU top employment prospects all over the world. This field experience, combined with the excellent teaching by the real-world experienced, distinguished faculty, prepares a forest engineering graduate to hit the ground running in his or her field. We learn to apply our forestry and engineering knowledge to plan and conduct complex forest operations that provide the wood Oregonians demand, while also protecting other resources such as water and aquatic habitat. For the immediate future, I have accepted a position as logging contract administrator with Longview Fiber Company. In that position, I will be responsible for managing some of the very same harvesting operations that triggered me to come to OSU. In fact, I accepted the position nearly 3 months before my expected graduation date. Such is the high demand for graduates of the forest engineering program that many students have jobs waiting for them months, even years in advance. This constant need for graduates is evidence that the forest engineering system works, and that the education I receive here will prepare me for a quick and sure entry into my career with the forest industry, one that still provides much of the economic basis of Oregon and the Pacific Northwest. Thank you.
Hi, Chair Devlin and committee members. I'm Rachel Cullen. I'm a student in wood science and technology at the College of Forestry. I came to OSU primarily because I was told I couldn't. I'm dyslexic, and when I was younger, I was told I couldn't come to college. So I decided I wanted to, and I was going to make that a possibility. So I'm sitting here before you today. While in high school, I worked with Wildlife Safari with their forest management program, education, and outreach. And I fell in love with it, and I just kept doing stuff that would lead me toward that. I did trail crew. I worked with the Wildlife Safari for another summer until I met George Swanson, where I learned all about the degrees, and I chose wood science. I chose wood science because it offered a wider range of options. I could do engineering. I could do chemistry. I could do management. I could do marketing. I could do anything I wanted to alongside it. And it had some of the best teachers in the United States in that department. Barb, who Howell was talking about, was my biology teacher for forest cells and forest science. Latesh is my structures teacher now. with pole preservation. Jeff is pole preservation, and he is was my preservation teacher as well. I love the major every year I'm in it. I've worked in the industry already for Rosebud Forest projects for the last two summers. Last summer, testing formaldehyde emissions. In the future, I would want to do consulting, and I just thank you very much for allowing me to be here with you today.
All right, Chair Devlin, committee members, thank you. My name is Jalen Sheffield, and I'm currently a senior in the Forest Management Program. I decided to enroll as a student at Oregon State University because OSU was able to offer a degree program that I was interested in and that I wanted to pursue as a career. I was pleased with OSU's reputation to provide students with endless educational resources such as the Valley Library, campus-wide computer facilities, and learning centers. I also wanted to make sure that I would be able to find a job related to my degree after I graduated, and was happy to see OSU's success rate for seniors finding jobs after graduation. Specifically, I selected the College of Forestry at OSU because it is recognized as a strong forestry college, not only in Oregon, but across the United States. I wanted to learn from professors who are leading professionals in the national resource field, and felt I would acquire a solid education and advantage over other forestry students from hands-on learning experiences during laboratory field trips to our research forests. I selected the Forest Management Program after my second summer of fighting wildland fire in South Central Oregon. While fighting fire, I was able to see various stages of stand succession, which increased my curiosity to study silviculture within ponderosa pine ecosystems. I wanted to broaden my knowledge with relationships associated with stand development in order to learn and understand how to reduce the threat of increasing catastrophic wildfires, while also improving forest ecosystem health. My experiences at Oregon State University have provided me with the opportunity to travel and take part in many leadership positions, such as becoming an ambassador for agriculture, forestry, and natural resources in 2006. The College of Forestry is assisting my career preparation by providing me with the tools necessary to manage diverse forest ecosystems through my coursework, along with enhancing my skills of public speaking and communication. The program has also helped me improve the educational skills needed to collaborate with colleagues for the benefit of meeting stand objectives and ecosystem sustainability. I feel OSU and the College of Forestry does an excellent job of challenging students to not only understand what they have learned, but interpret that information to others, as well as prepare students to learn how to solve problems individually and in a team atmosphere. After graduating with a degree in forest management, I will enter into a two-year Master's of Science degree program in the Forest Resources Department here at OSU. After completion of this degree, I hope to hold a career assisting private and agency foresters with the management options concerning ponderosa pine ecosystems and communicating why certain management objectives and techniques are selected over others to local community members. I am happy with my decision to have pursued and developed an interdisciplinary approach to forestry through the Forest Management Program here at Oregon State University. I am confident that this decision, along with my experiences at OSU, will contribute to my success as a professional in the natural resources field. One last thing that I would like to end with is I would like to touch on is that without proper funding, the level of diversity in classes and education and student experiences would not be possible. I believe it is important to support students by funding OSU courses to give students the opportunity to contribute their experiences, knowledge, and quality of education back to society and to the science community after they graduate. Thank you.
Question. Even though this is a natural resources, I'm going to ask you a question. Now, everybody comes from different economic backgrounds, so you may not be facing this as, but in the nature of your graduates, how much will you have in debt? That's for my other friend. You don't have to say specifically, but do you think your debt would be an issue? Or?
I'll go ahead and speak first, Chair Devlin. Yes, after completing, especially master's school, it'll be a few years before I'm able to pay off the loans. So it is very frustrating as a student because you're paying all this money all the time and you're not able to bring any money and any income in. So it feels like you're always paying out of your pockets and you keep on thinking yourself as a student, oh, I'm never going to be able to pay this off. But you know, if you're able to fight and you're competitive in the job market, then you find a job that you like, then you know, it's just something that you'll pay off in the end.
Well, I found that my hard work pays off well, so I don't have debt, that all the money I make during the summer goes to paying school and constantly at zero no matter what. And plus, I'm getting married, and my fiance has $22,000 in debt. I'm
fucking
it, no matter what.
I was fortunate, and it's a point that I didn't bring up, but in the timber industry, there's a lot of very generous individuals who have made it big, and they're more than willing to give back. And as such, the College of Forestry, I think, has probably, for the number of students that are enrolled, probably the highest per capita scholarship rate of any college in the university. And so I'm currently on a Homer scholarship, which roughly will cover tuition plus a little bit after return. So I'll be graduating with around $4,000 in debt.
Well, thank the three of you for coming tonight. I think the committee has very much enjoyed your testimony and the testimony before and everybody. I wanted to actually particularly hear from students who are in the program here. Thank you. Now we're going to have a very quick, almost shotgun approach. Ms. Ackerman, we have about seven items to go through on our revised list. And if you would just bring up the people that you need, if you could go through them
under
a minute at a time.
Chair Devlin, I'm under instructions to basically be about, I'm already half through my time. So we have a panel of folks here to respond to questions about the natural resource budget challenges, and I think you asked the question already, with the co-chair's budget, what would it mean for natural resources? Well, just the natural resource agencies, not counting your other hat on the education subcommittee, the co-chair's budget is 4% less than the governor's budget on general fund and lottery fund. And I just want to point out one really important thing. When Victor Atiyah left office as governor, 3% of the general funds of the state went to natural resource agencies. And in 2005-2007, it was less than 1%. So we're making a pathetic investment in our natural resource and environmental future in Oregon, and I'll leave it to my colleagues to address how pathetic that is when it comes to the higher education investment. I know the Institute for Natural Resources, the co-chair's budget cuts our budget in half, and I'm sure my colleagues are prepared to answer any questions you have about any of the other budgets.
If we could have just about 1 or 2 minutes each to go through these, that would be very beneficial, because I promised my committee we would finish up by 9, and I think I can keep your patience to about 9:05. I would point out, though, that one of the issues we have that I think is a little bit deceptive is in the legislature we try to portray the commitment to natural resources higher because we combine it with the lottery commitment. Most of us that actually sit on the budget committee know that the lion's share of those lottery dollars go to agencies and not broadly to natural resources.
And the 4% less number that I showed you, it was lottery and general fund. We're handing out a document that there's a poster somewhere in front of us that gives you the overview, and Dean Reed will take it from here.
Chair Devlin, committee members, the co-chair's recommended budget has no funding in it for the policy options packages that describes the preferred future of extension to address many of the issues I described earlier, and allows no or slowed progress in the general areas of, one, holes in service. We have areas of Oregon that have virtually no extension coverage. A good example is the extension forestry program on the South Coast, where there is no extension forester. And agent faculty are spread much thinner across multiple counties. Good examples are livestock agents used to have one county to cover, which was a big enough job, now are covering five counties. In addition to kind of restoring the capacity of the extension service, we won't be able to move forward in areas around bioenergy, watersheds, land use, food and wood innovation, science, technology, engineering, and math for youth, aging in place, coastal community resilience, and the 24/7 electronic extension initiative I mentioned.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, Director Koba and I talked about some of the new opportunities that we see for the agricultural sector, and those are what we focused on our program option packages that were submitted and approved by the Board of Higher Ed. A small amount was approved by the governor's office, and the co-chair's budget essentially zeroed that out. These are the areas that we were focusing on: bio-based products for health and for disease prevention, sustainable production and marketing systems, establishing an OSU Wine Institute, and by the way, the industry has agreed to raise $2 million of their own funds in support of that. Food innovation, water watersheds, freshwater and marine aquatic resources, bio-based energy systems, ecosystem services. And the reductions that we went through in the 0103 session essentially created numerous holes in our base programs. These are new innovative areas that we think will raise Oregon agriculture to a new level of economic contribution to the state.
Chair Devlin and members of the committee, with regard to the Forest Research Laboratory, the OUS policy package recommended an increase that had the possibility of being matched by an increase in the harvest tax that people who own forest land when they harvest timber pay, and the combined additional resources would allow us to fully implement four initiatives that have been prepared over the last 2 years, getting ready for the possibility that there would be some money in the state general fund someday. Those initiatives are the Oregon Wood Innovation Center, the Center for Intensive Plantation Silviculture, the Watershed Research Cooperative that deals with the effective forest practices on water quality and fish, and a forest health biomass energy initiative that would largely focus on federal lands and the opportunity and need to manage them to reduce their fire risk. And if those monies don't come through, we won't just not be starting those initiatives. We'll be actually taking 27% of our existing capacity out.
Chair Devlin, Katie Koba asked me to mention one other program where the Institute for Natural Resources is working very closely with the Department of Agriculture. The co-chair's budget also zeroed out the funding for the Oregon Sustainable Agricultural Resource Center, which is a cooperative Oregon Solutions project with very broad support, nearly 30 different signatory organizations, and the $1.1 million in that program option package is out of the co-chair's budget. $200,000 of that package would come to the Institute for Natural Resources. And another key area with tsunami risk and earthquake risk on the coast, there's a $5 million fiscal impact statement associated with the ocean mapping project, which is again part of the comprehensive information infrastructure we need for emergency preparedness in the state. That's it, unless you want to mention education.
Just one last comment, Chair Devlin, members of the committee, on the education funding in general. We thought the governor's recommended budget was pretty devastating to the foundational capacity of the university system to deliver education, but then we saw the co-chair's budget, and it was $35 million less. So we have serious challenges in even delivering the education to create the workforce that's in such high demand, we're in a College of Forestry, we literally have to roll enrollments back. We couldn't even maintain the enrollments we've got right now.
Thank you all for being here. On the side of the Natural Resources Committee, I'm hopeful that we can maybe do a few things with the business being able to do currently. On the education side, it's very challenging. And in fact, I can tell you from the co-chair's budget standpoint, I get in a little bit of trouble being this frank. But right now, I'm on the education subcommittee. As chair of the health side, I represent Lazio, who's doing a very able job. I'm the vice chair of the committee. We do not have the votes at this point in the committee to pass out the higher ed budget, college budget, student assistance budget, the 12 budget, or the department of ed. So we have a lot of people who are not satisfied with the budget picture also. Just to give you a view from sort of this side of the table. But I believe the legislature will continue to work hard over the next 3 months, and hopefully we can do better. And I want to thank everybody for being here tonight. I think it's been a very good informational hearing. Mr. Mills over there, Doc, who set this all up, I want to particularly say appreciation to him, and his message has been delivered well tonight. I reminded him that this was a Natural Resources Committee, not an Education Committee. He said he knew that, but there was a message that needed to be delivered there also. And I would like to thank my committee and staff, too, for coming out tonight. This is a really hard week for people because a lot of the people that are not on full ways and means have already been through so many hearings outside the building. And this week, Representative Gerard, Senator Nelson, myself, we have hearings every night this week through till Saturday, where we end up in Representative or Senator Nelson is having a good time this weekend. He's having it's his anniversary, and he told the coach of theirs that he has higher priorities. but some of us will be there through Saturday for hearings in North Bend. With that, I will close the hearing on both House Bill 5024 and 5002 and close this hearing.